Welcome to the second dialogue at Holden Community. The purpose of tonight's discussion is inclusive language. And we're going to be using a different structure than we typically do at Holden, something different from the typical forum where you will have a panel of people that will provide some input and then the folks listening can raise questions, etc. I'm going to explain what that process is. Some of you were at last week's dialogue, and I appreciate that you were back, because I will be calling on you in short order to talk about what that process was like for you as part of our getting into this dialogue tonight. Let me explain what a dialogue is. And I want to just acknowledge that we're in a different room tonight, and so if it's a little hard reading, I'll speak loudly so you can get this. I should say in preface to all of this is that in my practice as a consultant, I have been using this process for some time now and have just started using it as part of the inquiry process in the ELCA regarding the future of the church. What I want to say is that dialogue is an intentional and sustained inquiry into the following things: our assumptions, our certainties, and our processes. Assumptions, certainties, and processes function every day within the systems that where we live. There are certain things that are certain about what it means to be at Holden, the Holden way of things. Those have been presented to me in the term I would call certainties. There are assumptions. Some assumptions about we make about each other are sometimes right on, and other times they're just dead wrong. And so part of the process of dialogue is to have inquiries around our assumptions, whatever they may be in terms of a particular subject. So I always ask people, well, is that a certainty? Is that an assumption? Is that a judgment or observation? The third area, of course, is processes, sort of how things get done. And at some places, at IBM, for example, there are the IBM way of getting things done. Well, that kind of gets thrown out when you have forces that force you to rethink those. I think that there are Holden processes, and some of you probably could tell me what those are. These assumptions, certainties, and processes do a couple of things. They structure the common experience and often inform collective action. In other words, those are the things underneath our behavior. So part of the dialogue process is to begin to uncover those, shine the light on them, and look where they're look for a new meaning, insight, and perspective. This process called dialogue produces collective problem reframing. When you come to me and say the presenting problem is we have an inclusive language issue, my training tells me that yes, that's probably an issue. But there are lots of other things underneath that issue, and as we began to dialogue about that here at Holden Village, I think that there were some new discoveries of additional issues that sort of drive that. Paradigm restructuring, my sort of point of view about, in this case, God language, and what's your paradigm around language and how it's used. So I begin to uncover that. Shared meaning, so when I say God the Father, that means one thing to another person and another thing to another person, and so I've got to think about what is our shared meaning around the concept of God the Father or God the Mother. The next piece is a coherent foundation for what I call coordinated action. The result of dialogue oftentimes produces new meaning, a new way of looking at things, and in particular new insights that may provide an avenue or opportunity for us to work collectively as a community. So rather than being dialectic in polar opposites, we want to begin to have discussions along that continuum. And what dialogue begins to do is to begin to uncover the range of point of view on a particular subject. And again, the focus tonight is on inclusive language. This is what dialogue is. To illustrate it more effectively, there's a flip chart that I put up here, and I'll pull it down so that you have a notion. I guess I can't pull it down. This is called the continuum of conversation. This is how we sort of talk with one another. At the top of the page, you have a monologue. My mother was real good at that. She said, we are not having a discussion. This is not a debate. This is a monologue. I'm talking. You're listening. We have great monologues in Shakespeare. We often hear monologues on Sunday morning. And that's not what we're going to do tonight. Monologues are wonderful. They're part of the rich canon of how we talk with one another. We have something else called a controlled discussion. Now, a word about the word discussion. Discussion rhymes with percussion. Discussion tends to break things apart, and that often is important. Deconstruction is one of those kinds of things we do that sort of leads to breaking things apart. We're not going to do controlled discussion, and we're not going to do skill discussion. Skill discussion is often a debate. The root meaning of debate is to beat down. Ever walked out of a room after a debate? Felt beat up? Felt like you worked it to death and accomplished nothing? Again, I think that debates are often very important, but we're not going to do that tonight. There's something called strategic dialogue, and that's what we're going to engage in tonight, which is a discussion about the underlying meanings and structures and frameworks from which we have a point of view regarding inclusive language. A generative dialogue is different from a strategic dialogue. This is a focused dialogue. Generative dialogue would be if we were sitting in the room tonight and I just said, well, let's just see what comes up. It's sort of a kind of a, I think it'd be interesting for Holden to do that sometime. Let's just sort of see what comes up, but we're not going to do that tonight. So on the continuum from monologue to generative dialogue, we're going to be at about step 4. And in a minute, I'm going to have some people come up and talk about what that process was. To sort of hold us in this container of thoughtful dialogue, we're going to suggest a few ground rules. And they're the following. Number one, consider diversity as a learning opportunity. And what we mean by that is that there is diversity of thought in the room. And what I want to suggest is that we hold out the intention that we let all of that range of diversity come forward. And that it's an opportunity for rich insight. The second ground rule is notice where you're listening from. And this is an assignment for us all, because I think it has a lot to do with what I call inclusive listening. Notice where you're listening from. Are you listening from disturbance or defenses? Are you listening from your own self-image? Are you listening from the net of thought? Now, I want to explain this because this is a business term, so I'm not going to assume that you know what I'm talking about. But we have a term in business called net it out. So if you start with Abba Ema and I end with the end of the prayer, I've missed the middle of it. The net of thought is getting to the end. So don't cut people's sentences off, both in your mind and in your hearing. Because oftentimes there's a surprise. The fourth one is, are you listening from impulse of thought? In other words, Martin starts talking and then my mind clicks in and I'm impulsed to do, I'm thinking about something totally different. I want to suggest that you listen from the point of view of silence. Quiet mind, as some other traditions have tried to teach us. So I want to call on that tradition that you might want to consider quiet mind and really listen deeply to what you're hearing without your own personal editing. That's what we mean by notice where you're listening from. The third ground rule is a request that you speak without blame or judgment. So rather than saying, this is the way it is, I would suggest you talk about, this was my experience, this is my observation. The fourth is pay attention to what is going on for you. Where do you experience irritation? Where do you experience additional thoughts? What gets triggered inside of you? And the fifth is, this can be fun. So why don't we also give ourselves permission to do that? Any questions about the process before I move on? If you want to get up going. Good. All right.
Wait.
Yes.
I had a question last week when we got to this point, and I disappointed myself and the group by not asking it, so I'll try and do that tonight. And I hope not to embarrass my co-leader.
Okay.
Because I should have asked this before.
Oh, so this is one of those surprises.
No, I'm not going to.
That's okay, Martin.
I got the sense when we did this last time that when you talked about a container, the metaphor worked for me that only that which was in the room at the moment counted in the conversation. Is that what you mean?
Exactly. And people who are not here did not participate in the dialogue. And the only way for them to participate was to show up at the next time we have an opportunity to do it. Now, lots of people who were not there learned a lot about it because some of you went out and talked about your experience, and that's great. But the notion of the container is really, whoever is in the room, you're the participants.
Then the second part of the question, if that's clarified, is if there are some who come to the conversation assuming a normative tradition, is that kept outside the container, or is that brought into the container through individuals, or how does that work into the dialogue?
That gets brought into the container if they're present in the room and if they choose to participate in the dialogue.
Okay.
As long as, if they don't choose to participate in the dialogue, it can't enter into the container.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions before we move on?
This seems pretty hard. What if we do it wrong?
Well, the advanced Holden Laboratory will be held next week.
And you will be the leader.
Well, one thing we know about God is that God is inclusive and God is merciful. So we will all be merciful in our attempt to get through this. What I'd like to do is I want to do a quick dialogue. So for people who have not done this before, so I need 7 of you from last week to help me out. So could 7 of you please come up here in the circle and help me out for 10 minutes? Thank you.
Okay, we need some women in there.
Yeah, I'll put my hand. Okay.
Okay, one of the other things I wanted to say is that at any given time, you may have a couple empty seats. The way this works is if you're listening, these people talk up here, your job is to listen. If you feel like talking, you must join the circle. So at any given time, we have a couple of chairs available. So I'd like to ask if there would be a couple more people that would be willing from last week to please join the circle. One more, please.
We'll swing down for you to
Great, thank you. Now we have an open chair. We can call that Sarah's chair for now. Or Rachel's chair. All right. What we'd like you folks to engage in, and we're going to really try to keep our time tonight, so Martin, can you help me on this one? The question is this. I would like from your perspective to talk about what you experienced last week and any particular insights or thoughts you've had since our initial dialogue on inclusive language. We'll start there. We're going to run your group for 10 minutes and then we'll see where we are. Have at it.
Well, I experienced a very wide range of expressions of how certain kinds of liturgical language functions for people, and people expressed ways that certain metaphors or ways of naming God to hurt them. I heard other people expressing how certain ways of naming God or metaphors for God connected them to the tradition of the larger Christian community from the time of the disciples up till now, and almost everything in between. Some of the issues are theological, and some of the issues are emotional, and so there was just a really wide range of how language affects people, especially in a liturgical context.
One of the points that I heard about, I didn't actually hear it because I left early.
Can you talk just a little louder?
Okay. I left early last week, but one of the things that I heard about reminded me of something that one of my professors taught us when we talked about how you deal with ancient philosophy texts, which don't use feminine pronouns ever. And the idea, as I understood it, having had it reported to me, was that you have to strike a balance between some continuity with tradition and some acknowledgement that things have changed. And I think that that's maybe a good place to start from today, or a good thing to consider today.
One of the things I experienced last time was that, first of all, I enjoyed the process because it seemed like points of view came out that were within me, but probably were at more the ends than my opinion would be. So I felt like my point was represented even more ably than maybe I would have. My experiences with the pain that people expressed or the strong feelings they expressed were more a little more distant, because I have a sister who has been very hurt by male God language. On the other hand, I really connect with the historical, and I relate to what you're saying as far as, and yet I don't have the knowledge base of some people who maybe have gone through all the education and have learned to connect so strongly with the male language that it would be difficult for them to speak it in other ways. So I'm sort of in the middle too, but the process, this sort of process, was helpful for me.
I experienced a lot of deep disappointment with the church and its, I think, the failure of the church to teach and to preach in such a way that people are not hurt by the liturgical and theological tradition of the church, but are liberated by it, are able to experience the freedom that is in the gospel. And I think I began to understand once again how deeply emotional and painful a lot of the catechetical work of the church has been, a lot of the liturgical work of the church. I think I was especially saddened by the fact that the Lutheran Book of Worship came out right on the balance edge between sensitivity to inclusive language for people, which was incorporated into the work of the commission, and language for God, which was, if it was on the horizon at all, was not considered. And the consequence of that, I think, is that we have a flawed vehicle available to us for worship in the Lutheran tradition. If we had been 5 years later, 10 years later, as the as the books that are now coming out by the Methodists, the Presbyterians, the Episcopalians, and so on, we might not have some of the issues and the difficulties and the problems. So I experienced an enormous amount of sadness and disappointment for the enterprise that I have to represent. I also had one other almost sort of aha moment, and that was that what we are talking about is not just language, but God. And when we talk about God, we experience an enormous set of problems because we are living in a culture, in the Western world at least, where the very notion of God is problematic, where it's questionable. And one of the things that the church's theoreticians have to work with is to ask the question, how can we talk about God at all? And if we can talk about God, with what warrants, on what ground? And one of my questions was whether a dialogical method that is an attempt to bring many points of view together can, in the last analysis, move us to the ultimate question, which is, how can we talk about God publicly in a fundamentally secular world? And it was difficult for us to move from the level of experience to the level of further kinds of questions. And I think one of the problems then is, what do we do with our experiences? Respect them, of course. Try to understand them, of course. But can we do anything beyond that? Can we challenge them? Can we question them? Must we do that? Ought we to do that? Do we owe each other that? And last week and this week already, we have had in the teaching sessions an awful reminder of what happens when experience becomes the criterion for God, namely the Nazi years. The Deutsche Christen, the German Christians, sought to fashion God in terms of their own image. They rejected the Jewishness of Jesus. They tried to make him a white, Aryan, male exemplar of all of the elements of Germanism. And so they painted their pictures of Jesus and drew their images of Jesus and their theology of Jesus from their own Germanness, and would not let themselves be challenged by the historical Jesus. They had to reshape the historical Jesus, transform the historical Jesus into something that was demonic and terrible and destructive. And I think the whole world paid terribly for that dreadful experiment in making experience the criterion for how one thinks about Jesus and how one thinks about God. I'm German. I still smart and hurt from that scar on the 20th century and on humanity and of the world. And I think what we need to deal with is the fact that both experience and tradition have ambiguities about them. They can be badly used or well used. They can be demonically done or redemptively done. And I guess my concern in the whole of the conversation is that we begin to look at the relationship between experience and tradition in as redemptive a way as possible, and not in as demonic a way as is easily also possible.
Just comment a little bit on what I had talked about the last time we were in this, and that was...
A little louder.
I ended up being part of growing up in the campus ministry in the late 60s and early 70s when actually inclusive language was really going on in the University of Washington area, and our programs had worked with inclusive language on a direct level, and we as the other gender became as passive to be able to be let that happen, and it was a growing experience for the people in campus ministry to do that. My reflection is from the week that has followed is from the time that we did this earlier is that I've heard of discussions going on about our time there. And I did see and experience the pain of the people that were in the first session. The only thing I would think of taking it further and not looking at more or less the past and the history of the church in itself, but also we should look at where the church is now and where can we go from here. And not only with inclusive language, but help within the church structure to include all people of all races and all people.
I think one of the best things for me that happened last week was to celebrate the fact that I wasn't alone in my thinking, that God for other people is not always male and not always father, and that's an okay thing. To appreciate the struggle and to work with it, and I was really thrilled with that and have been involved in conversations all week and that evening, and even my dearest friend and I had never talked about this, and that was very important to share the differences that we have. I was very disappointed that children never entered in the conversation last week. And what our language, when we refer to God, affects the child and how that forms them and limits them. And our church needs to start thinking not just of us, but of everyone, including the children. And I hope that in our conversations tonight and in the future, that enters into it.
You brought up one thing that night affected me too, the children part. Because the one reaction I guess that didn't come in that was that, and one of the things I do in my volunteer life is I play music for 2 and 3 year olds at church and their parents. And that really, in my practice, is where I've dealt with inclusive language. And in some ways that, in how personally I want to put that into play, and it's sort of, in a way, related to what people were saying, because what I rewrite a lot of the children's songs to be inclusive, and if it says he, I say God. But then I run into ones where it just doesn't work. And it's sort of like the creeds, I guess, is sort of where I saw the parallel, that it was sometimes hard if you're going to... And there's quite a few songs that I don't use because it just is too hard to, like, I will make you fishers of men. I've never figured out fishers of people somehow just doesn't do it. And so I haven't used that one. But I do use one because it's one that is well known outside of the, and that is he has the whole world in his hands. And we've ended up using that one that has a he pronoun in it, and we've used that because the kids love it, the parents love it, it's something they're hearing out in the society, and I figured I can't rewrite it and have it be very meaningful to people. I mean, it's going to be, so that's the one I've used that has a he pronoun in it. But otherwise, my reaction is the same as yours. I don't want to limit little children's experiences when the process is in the middle of change. That I don't, yeah.
Oh, no. I think it's important sometimes on the subject of children to remember that there are a lot of little girls in the church who don't feel included either in their relationship with God or as a part of God's family. When I taught Sunday school this year, we did many, many verses of Father Abraham and many kids. And that's not the way the song was written. But I wasn't going to teach my little girls that Father Abraham had many sons. It just wasn't going to happen. And that, I think that is a really important place that we didn't, as far as I know, talk about last week. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah.
We'll have kids. What can I say?
Kids some sort of sometimes really clarify things.
Well, they do, and I've been one, and I guess the hurt started there, and it carried on. But you could use God instead of he. God's
yeah.
Got the whole, it works.
It works, yeah.
I've done it, yeah.
Okay.
Why is limit a negative term, though? I mean, I think three of you now use the word limit as a negative term.
To children's experience.
But don't you when you are initiating your children into the world, set limits on some things? Don't touch a hot stove. Is that a limit?
That is a guidance. Limit in using father. I had a great father. My children do not have a father. They have a great mother, but I...
Why not?
But I am so less than God that I don't want them in their young minds to think of parent as God. I want them to think beyond Creator, Lord God. It needs to be done with reverence. And I think a comment was made last week, something about God being referred to as a bird. I feel very fortunate that I haven't had that experience. But God to me is always reverent, is always more than the parent figure, is so far beyond. And to me, that is not or no longer a limit.
Do you ever ask, and any of you, how the Christian tradition might enable you to? I think you're raising the hardest kinds of questions, because one of the things that's very difficult to do is to share with children languages that do not grow directly out of their operational and concrete experience of the world. And I think one of the ways, I think language about God is easily some of the most difficult language language about God, just period, in general, is some of the most difficult kind of stuff that we try to share with children. And I wonder whether maybe we oughtn't just avoid it until they are beyond the age of concrete operations. And instead, try to make use of the fundamental tradition that's available to us as Christians, and that is narrative, first of all, storytelling. That's what children are into and are available. Makes the Christian tradition available to them. Storytelling and action are the kinds of things that are available. Now, what do we have in the tradition that's there for us to tell? Among other things, the story of Jesus, which is the Christian access to language about God. And what we can do is to start with the story of Jesus. There's rich material there for inclusivity, for opening them up, for liberating them, for participation in the Christian tradition. And there are actions, going to places, being with people, doing certain things, kneeling, folding their hands, participating in a meal that is about the story of Jesus. I think it's very unfortunate that we deny children one of the things that they're easily able to do, and that's eat and drink. But I would not really begin to talk then about God until children are beginning to be able to take in abstract concepts, abstract languages, because at the theoretical level at least, which children are able to enter into maybe from age 10 onward, God is an essential theoretical element. And if they've been schooled in the stories of Jesus, or the story, the biblical narratives that are appropriate, they can move then from that concrete narrative level to some more abstract and theoretical concepts and activities. I would find it very difficult. Just even think of it first thought.
I think
they can't hear you.
I think
we're going to close off for two more minutes.
Okay, so good. I'll better make it short. I think, first of all, it's enjoyable that children was brought up in the process here. But I think we as people that have families is that we make those decisions and not the church make those decisions on our operation of working with our children and working on the concept of raising them to understand God within the family structure. The other thing is in our American Indian background that I am from, that because God is such a strong power, that we have not the ability to put a word on the word God himself. So in our sense, because we know God being so strong, it ends up we do not really have a word for God to stand there and say that he has like a quote title or something that we can understand.
One issue that I wish could get addressed eventually that we just didn't have time for last week and we went till 11 o'clock at night was finding ways to distinguish between public texts and various levels of public texts, liturgical texts, canonical texts versus private texts for prayer. I happen to believe that almost everybody in the room last week was for inclusive language, and I happen to know that a whole bunch of people who spoke for the traditional liturgical texts have spent much of their lives working to promote inclusive language and inclusive God talk language. But we still have to ask, do we have, you know, how responsible is it to take common liturgical texts and canonical texts and alter them as we see fit? I mean, how many of you would like to hear the Passion narrative read that Jesus died praying, Abba, Ima, forgive them for they know not what they do. And Abba, Ima, into thy hands I commit my spirit. I mean, are we going to change the Bible? Or are we going to admit there's limited language there in this canonical text? Because Jesus, as best we can tell, happened to experience God as Father and articulated it that way. Now, we can go ahead and translate this in our minds and build all sorts of other texts we can use among ourselves that we're not going to ask everybody else in the world to buy or to use and to make the canon or public texts. So a lot of these distinctions need to be made about which texts are public and alterable, public and not alterable, canonical, and so forth. There's a lot of issues there.
Thank you. And on this note, I'd like the three of you to voluntarily move, and some of the rest of you to stay. So whoever wants to move. So you're stuck, Walt. Now, I'd like the rest of those chairs to be filled by people who want to join in the dialogue. And we can't have a dialogue if people are just sitting in. So we'll start when all those chairs are filled.
Was that too subtle? As Anthony would like to say, y'all come down now.
Thank you. Three more. Thank you. Two more. Yes, I feel like that's stretch and bluegrass stretch. Okay, one more.
All my books.
Isn't that supposed to be an empty chair in the circle?
I thought we had one.
That's
the ball. Oh, okay. You're coming. Great. Pull in one more empty chair for people to join. Thank you. All right. Martin and I had a fairly lengthy discussion based on last week's learnings and musings and reflections. We're going to start the dialogue off this evening. We spent the first part of it sort of getting a sense of what happened last week, and I think even out of that dialogue there's some good questions. But Martin has an initial question to start this dialogue off with. Have at it, my partner.
Okay. This is the question we'd like to start with. It's not really fair to lay it on you this way, but next week you can lead. At least one paradigm for knowing how people receive and process information is the Myers-Briggs. We've had a wonderful experience at Holden Village with the Myers-Briggs. There's something important in that it recognizes at least 16 major types, according to that one scheme, for the way people process, receive, and reflect on and make conclusions about information. And my question is, how does a person who primarily receives and processes information as a sensate through touch and experience and feels deeply, so-called SF person, a sensate feeler, of which we had a wonderful representation last week, how does a sensate feeler talk across the various categories of processing information to another type in the 16s, which I would call the intuitive thinker? That's the question. And I realize I'm leaving you with a lot of unanswered definitions about what those kinds of people are, but hopefully that's enough to get you started. Is that enough to get you started?
If that's a how question, I would say that you do it by studying Enneagrams.
Wrong paradigm.
I was teasing.
Because in some ways, although I really always balk at Myers-Briggs or any other kind of thing, because I think one of the real problems that we have in our society is labeling. And so we tend to, because we live in such a structured society where I go to the bank and then, you know just how to act at the bank, I go to the grocery store, I know just how I'm supposed to act, I know this, that we tend to really get into labeling people. So I've
when I first came here, the Myers-Briggs was really important. And it was really almost impossible to talk about people without talking about the Myers-Briggs. And so we could never talk about things in terms, we could never use biblical language, but we have to use Myers-Briggs language, Briggs language. So, but I think that one of the things that it gets to is that I think that our society has, for centuries, evolved and has been a patriarchal society. And so that I think that that does indicate that even the discussion of this issue, and many people will value certain ways of talking about things above other ways. And so people will imply, and I notice in the language of theology, the language of implication is used a lot. People will imply that, well, it was good to hear it from you, but now here's the real way to talk. And I think that it's important then that that we recognize that even that discussion is shaped by centuries of patriarchal society. And even the way we talk, and to a great degree, the way we look at the world. And that's, we think by, in some schemas, that maybe we've moved somewhat out of that, but I don't think we have. I think we've only moved a little ways. And because I think we still think mostly that way.
The question, as I understood it, was how, not being familiar with Myers-Briggs, really, was how do two people who are fundamentally very different speak to each other? Would you say that's accurate?
And thinking primarily of the people who receive and process information in a sensate way, mm-hmm. and process that through powerful emotional feelings.
How, not being familiar with Myers-Briggs, really, was how do two people who are fundamentally very different speak to each other? Would you say that's accurate?
And thinking primarily of the people who receive and process information in a sensate way, mm-hmm. and process that through powerful emotional feelings, mm-hmm. which are very real and present. I sensed last week that there was a huge gulf across which there could not be communication between that and others who process information primarily in an interior way and then through systematic reflection. Neither one better than the other, nor better or worse than the other 14 ways of classifying according to this scheme, which is fallible. But for purposes of this question, that's the scheme we work with.
Okay, well, I read a sociologist who said that disagreement is a very difficult thing to reach, and that Americans often get to confusion and think that they've gotten to disagreement. So, I don't know who said that. I think one thing to recognize, you know, even between these two very different ways of approaching the world, is that there's a tremendous commonality in what we in this room happen to believe about language and about God. And I think that recognizing areas of agreement would be a really good place to start for those two people who have very different styles of processing. For instance, no one would argue that we should tell children stories about Jesus. We do it every day in Narnia and other places. Mm-hmm. And so that would be a huge area of agreement. That's something that we should do. We should hold Jesus up as a model for children. And so I think agreeing on areas of common ground is a good place to start. And then to reach disagreement, and to be very specific on areas where there are disagreement, would clarify the further discussion.
Although Myers-Briggs would have you believe that I'm one of the thinking, like, completely logical people, I haven't had that experience with myself. And I tend to think that it's not as completely divided as we tend to believe sometimes. I think I'm capable of rational thought, and yet I've had some very devastating emotional experiences within the church. And I think that we're maybe more alike than we realize, and we have more common ground than we tend to admit generally.
Yeah, I think that that's true. And I think that particularly when we're talking about issues such as we are, it really gets to people's emotional gut levels. And we not only, I mean, it's not like, some people may speak with more emotion about these issues because of the experiences they bring in. It may not necessarily be because of a certain personality type. And I think that, as you were saying before, as much as we can't focus our theologies on experience, we also need to listen to those experiences and treat them as valid, so as not to say, okay, well, we've heard you, and now we're going back to the way it really is. You know, I mean, I think the point to move towards is to hear the experiences and you know, different intellectual ideas and kind of combine those and say, okay, this is the best way that we can serve each person involved.
I guess I want to play off that, in fact, to play off a lot of things that were said here, and to say that one of the questions we can ask is, how can we use the tradition of the church to discover agreement on the one hand, or to discover resources to respond to patriarchalism, or to discover ways to hear important dimensions of experience. Back in the civil rights movement, there were instances of African American people bursting into churches with reparation demands, and the responses of the churches, I think, were incredibly inept in making use of traditions available to us. At Riverside Church, what they did in New York was to hire police to guard the doors and make sure that these people didn't enter into the churches and disrupt the worship. But what if instead they had had the LBW available to them? And, hang on a minute. I was a participant in designing the services of confession and forgiveness that are in the LBW. And one of those services, the service of corporate confession, has a huge section in it, not for a sermon, not for preaching, but for listening to the legitimate grievances of people who have been harmed and hurt and alienated and oppressed and destroyed by the church. And the whole service is designed to enable the Christian community to listen to those experiences of hurt and alienation. I don't know whether parishes, Riverside Church, any are employing that resource. But at Trinity Seminary, when we began to have women students, and it was difficult for them to be heard, the president, Fred Moiser, scheduled a confession, a service of corporate confession. We had men in the seminary who were not willing to come to chapel if a woman was preaching. We had men who were not willing to receive the Eucharist from women who were assisting ministers. We didn't have, to get into another level, we didn't have appropriate laboratory facilities for women at a seminary that was built in the 1950s, only for men. What Fred did in a series of services of corporate confession, because you're not going to deal with this in one, is to let the people who were hurt have voice, say how they were hurt, and then pastorally and collectively to have all of us repent, because that's what the church is about, and to translate that repentance into concrete action. Again, these are not the kinds of things that happen overnight or in one or two or half a dozen sessions. They happen over a period of months and of years to communities that are intentional about being agents of reconciling grace. That's a resource. I think another resource that ought to be sought is not to ask how are we going to do it right, but what are the resources in the tradition itself, in the biblical tradition, and particularly in the stories of Jesus, that are anti-patriarchal, that are designed not to be patriarchal. I want to point simply to one. It is, it was, let me put it that way, it was in the church's development of the doctrine of the Trinity heretical to think of the basic God, the fundamental God, as Father, and Christ and the Spirit as additions. It's very important when one looks at the history of the doctrine of the Trinity to begin to discover what the foundations of that doctrine are, what it grew out of, what it is trying to give expression to, and how the word Father then comes to be used in that doctrine as an anti-patriarchal resource for the church, as a way for the church to combat patriarchalism. I think there are traditions in this country, particularly, I notice it particularly in ex corde prayer, where one assumes, ex corde, not written down, where you're praying spontaneously, that one begins massively with a kind of God is Father, and then if Jesus is in there at all, it's sort of an appendage. I think that's inappropriate, awfully inappropriate prayer. It's not good Trinitarian prayer to start with. But beginning with Jesus is also critical, and it's critical for a lot of the justice issues that we have to deal with. If one relativizes Jesus, then it's impossible for us to use the Jesus story, for example, in the service of peace. Because one could say, Jesus had to deal only with swords and spears and with looking people in the eye when they were in combat. So turning the other cheek was appropriate then. But it's not appropriate now in an age where we've got atomic weapons and telescopic rifles. I want to say no, it is also appropriate now. So one cannot say, Jesus was stuck in a kind of patriarchal language game, and therefore we don't have to pay attention to his use of the term Father for a relationship that he had with one in whose mission he participated. I think this is what it means for Christians, in a sense, to be bound by and probably also offended by elements of the very concrete historical character of what it means that Jesus is the grounding for all that we say about God and about peace and about liberation and about freedom and about the coming of the reign of God.
Other thoughts in this group? People haven't spoken.
Well, back to the original question, I just think that any communication needs to involve relationship. The way that you make change is to be in relationship with people, to have mutual respect, whether you agree or disagree. To, as a friend of mine says, be gentle with each other, be compassionate, but challenge, and let the conversation happen. But it doesn't happen from somebody saying this is the way it is. It happens from relationship.
Okay, I'd like another three people from this group to leave. And I'm going to invite another visitor.
And I'd like to invite three additional people to join the service, please. Quickly.
And that's something that really bothers me.
I felt myself up there retreating into two very familiar places in me. One is curled up in a little ball on the floor, sucking my thumb. And another is being a kid and acting out and being obnoxious. kicking the wall and making jokes. And I don't like either of those places. And then I thought, well, if I'm not going to go either of those places, what do I feel? And I realized I felt this enormous weight descending on me again, a familiar, old, enormous weight that I just didn't want to deal with. I just didn't want it anymore. I guess I'm saying I'm having a very emotional reaction to this whole thing. I hear Walt lecturing, and he lectures persuasively and charmingly and intelligently in an articulate way, in a way like many of my best professors when I was in college. And I find myself becoming a goddamn child. And I don't like that. I don't like having my maturity as a Christian departing from me. And I think, why is this happening? Why am I becoming a kid? I think of myself as a grown-up. I experience my Christianity as a grown-up most of the time. I feel as though the church has reached out to me and brought me back from some place that I went. I went there in college, I disappeared. I majored in religion in college. And all of a sudden I think, I don't know enough to argue with these people. I'm not a theologian. I'm not sophisticated enough. Oscar Anderson, when I was in 10th grade, finishing 3 years of confirmation, I asked me to tutor somebody else in the class. And I came to him in great distress one day and said, what if she doesn't learn enough to pass? What if she doesn't learn enough to become, to be saved? What if I fail? And now I think, what if I don't know enough to get this right? And then I think there is something wrong going on here. And then I know what I know from having been a feminist a long time, and that is that women have claimed their true path by pulling away from men and figuring it out for themselves. And I just think that's the path that I need to get onto again now. I would like a church that left behind all those arguments and was just smart, good, rooted women to start working on this stuff. And maybe in 50 years we could talk about reconciliation with the men. But in the meantime, I feel like the only true road is a road that we would just take ourselves, because I don't trust him. I find I don't trust him. I don't trust Walt. Even though he's so smart and so kind and so persuasive, I just am freaking out hearing all of that. And so, you know, then I go to that place that says, okay, I can find my own true path with my sisters. I wanted Tom to come down because I feel like Tom's one of my sisters. So I guess when I say women, I'm saying something not quite that, but that's where I am.
Is there some way to express what we feel without judging the other? Is that possible?
I trust Walt. I have lived with him for 30 some years, almost 40 years. I would not be in the church today without Walt. And I think part of the problem is we came here from the very beginning with a terrible prejudice. Walt is for something and therefore we're against it because half. And that's not true. And I think there is nothing that can be said here when you start from there. If you start not trusting, there is nothing that can be said. And there's no way we can communicate until we respect and trust each other. Mm-hmm. And I think that includes men and women, Sure, we've had trouble. Sure, we've been put down. But that doesn't mean we have to start now putting everybody down that is involved with us and not trust everybody just because we happen to maybe not trust somebody. And I don't think grouping everyone in the same category works.
I really appreciate that, and I agree with that. And I need to say that I trust Walt. Walt is a metaphor. It's not Walt that I don't trust.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. No, we can't do that. We can't do that and be Christians. We take each other seriously. We talk to each other. We cannot group. Even though blacks know how it is to be put down. Women know how it is to be put down. All of us probably face this. We all want power. We all want to be somebody. We all want to be somebody at the expense maybe of somebody else. And when we aren't smart enough to talk, when we aren't smart enough to do something, like you said, then we say, my opinion is good as everybody else's. There are no experts here. That doctor can't tell me anything. And I should say now, I don't have that cancer because I don't believe it. Mm-hmm. We do have experts in all fields. Why is it that theology has none? Why can't we listen sometimes? We certainly can talk to each other, but why is it that there are fields that can't have any experts?
Or does that same expert thing work? I mean,
both ways, but I haven't seen Walt being putting other people down. I really haven't seen that. Yeah. And I have seen a lot of people. I can't believe emotionally. I can't. I'd be not a Christian today if I had to. Because I'm one of these people that is not an emotional believer. I respond emotionally just like everyone else does. I also respond intellectually when I can. I don't have the abilities to express myself, basically because I haven't done it for many, many years, openly. But I think I am still able to listen, and I think I'm still able to understand. And I think we can speak to each other. And I think we can listen to each other. And I think we can also listen when someone, I mean, how many people have asked, well, what is the tradition? Why are there some people not willing to give up? And why do we need, I mean, it doesn't help to change a word from father to mother for me. Because my mother was very dominant in my family, and my poor father finally was free when she died, really. Okay, so, you know, that can be both ways. We can have experiences both ways. Some of us have not experienced some things that others have. I, you know, in the workplace and so forth.
I guess maybe if I could try to speak to both. First of all, I can relate to your feeling that you came here with. When I was in college, I was fortunate enough to be in an environment where it was most of the time inclusive language, but there were those times when it was only filer language, and I reacted much like you say that you did. I would act like a kid again, and it was like I was back in the corner not really paying attention to anything. And so I really relate to that emotionally. But at the same time, I think that what Walt kind of was saying before with the whole Lutheran Book of Worship liturgy is that there are places within that liturgy that can help speak to those people who are hurting. And I think at the same time, there are places in the Bible that really speak to women And, you know, we can use those messages. That's the problem. It's like, not only has our culture, like, put people on the margin, but we as theologians or churchgoers have also, like, put certain parts of the Bible on the margin. And so we don't talk about those issues, you know, like, why can't we use the metaphor that Jesus uses as a mother searching for a lost coin or a mother hen gathering the, you know, and then we can use the father image as well and kind of try to bring it all. I mean, if we stay with the tradition, that's what I think maybe the direction we need to move is, just to be inclusive more as it's written.
When I was 5 years old, I had an extremely clear vision of God. Big, tall, white guy on the heavy side, wore a plaid jacket. He looked a lot like Walt. And I loved that God very much. And by the time that I was 20 or so, I no longer could relate to that vision. That was, someone described last week how the language of the liturgy, the continual God, he leapt off the page of them. It seemed to glow. And I went through that phase, that really, I would call it now a real defensive feminist kind of, where I needed to kind of sort out for me what was going on. What I feel now, a few years later, about this issue, speaking to the creeds and the Lord's Prayer, is that our Father is no longer for me a term of oppression. What I feel beaten down by is not our Father, not in the creeds and not in that prayer that Jesus taught us, but the continual holding up of masculine images at the expense of the ones that you raised. So I do think that we need balance. We need non-gendered images also. When I hear that exclusive language, it doesn't hurt me in the way that it once did, but what I think it does is that it damages the people who use it because it limits them to one particular conception.
I'd like to talk a little bit about what you brought up, Anthony. And I don't know if I can organize my thoughts. Because I have to express to you that part of this issue, part of my dealing with this issue has been that made this, it's been one of the reasons why this has been sort of a hell on earth for me, this place. And I mean it. I have been really butchered from people on both sides of this issue. And I'll try to tell you why. As a pastor in the job description, and this is why we're having these forums now, which even makes it harder for me, but it makes it better for the village, I think. That's in my job description to deal with the issue of inclusive language. We have books, we have Bibles, we have songbooks, most of which use mostly exclusive language in reference to God. The Bibles are not even up to date. They're not even New Revised Standard Version. And as most scholars will tell you, many things that are in the original text in Hebrew and Greek, even up to the Revised Standard Version, still use male exclusive pronouns where it's not even a gender male, where it's a neuter, for example, in Greek. So we have that. So in one sense, I'm called to be the language police. So if somebody gets up and reads exclusive language from the Bible, and somebody just got off the bus and somebody asked them to use it in Vespers, and so they read out of the Bible and somebody gets mad at them. And then they come to me, how come you're using exclusive language here? So that comes from the other end. Then I get people who are supporting certain forms of what I would call personally exclusive language, coming to me and issuing veiled threats, you know, that, you know, but the bishop said this, you know, the bishops said we have to use Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. How do you, you know? And so then I get it from that other, the other side. And I think there are other people that have those experiences too. I think what I've observed through this whole experience is something that maybe I could just share from my past, is that I think much of it is an issue of whether people have an authoritarian view of the world or not. And I think that that is very linked to our history. And I think we're not going to be able to solve this issue if we do not deal with the issue of how we look at whether we are really fundamentally a literal, we look at the scriptures literally, or whether we look at them in another way. Because back to Fred's issue about public speech, the Bible is, even if we take out all the all the places where he was put in when it shouldn't have been in the original languages, even if we take that out, it's predominantly patriarchal images. So if we go through the text, we use the lectionary, and we just by percentages, we're going to end up with mostly male patriarchal images. So that is really where that issue of the canon comes down, is that we are in a situation where if we just leave it the way it is and we say that this is what we have to do publicly all the time, that is what's going to come out. And what we're speaking and talking about then is in situations that where people do just get up and do public things, it's the predominance is going to be male imagery. Some of the ways that people deal with that is, for example, instead of simply saying Abraham, I say Abraham and Sarah, or Sarah and Abraham. That's added to the text. That's an addition to the text. The other place I would go with that is I think there is a long tradition of not being literal about the Bible. There are traditions of Martin Luther saying things like, throw out the book of James. It's a straw epistle. And my name is James, so I think to suggest that somehow we should not consider looking at the biblical text really also leaves out part of the wrestling and struggling that people did in the past. And we are dealing with an issue that has had consciousness before in the church. I just was reading, and I'm not a church historian, so I suppose I'm in a place for lots of correction here. But this is a woman from Latin America who's struggling with this issue, and her name is Bingamer. And she found a text in the Council of Toledo in 675 AD that says, we must believe that the Son did not come from nothing, nor from any other substance, but he was begotten or born, genitus venatus, from the maternal womb of the Father. That's 675 AD. The thing that has happened is we have gone even more exclusive and we have even left out, this is where I would really agree with Walt, although we probably wouldn't agree with how much to deal with the Trinity, is that we have lots of tradition that can go back and find those feminine images. But we really have to be intentional, because if we're not intentional, it will end up to be patriarchal, because that's what we have in the canon. And so I think we just have to struggle with it. We really have to have a lot of courage, because there's so much fear that gets into the issue. I have a lot of. I think. Fear is an element that I might inject that most every clergy person deals with and you cannot ignore when this is discussed. And it's, for me, and I have to bring this out on the table, the reason I am afraid is because of the bishop's statement. It actually issues fear into my soul, and I believe that's also then linked to an authoritarian hierarchical view of the world.
Could you explain what the bishop's statement is?
The bishop's statement is that we must baptize in the name of the Father, of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Do you know the reason why? Why did they come out with that statement?
I can't give all the reasons, no. I'm just telling you how I feel. I'm telling you we can't ignore the fact that for most clergy, the fear of that statement, no matter knowing or not knowing why they did it, I feel like it's even dangerous for me to sort of talk the way I'm talking now. And because it probably could jeopardize my job and my family. And so that's what I'm trying to say.
You're also alluding to the vows that one takes at ordination to do certain things, to uphold certain things as a contract to being an ordained or on the clergy roster. Those are a range of things that include both personal behavior as well as
I would like to add two things to that, Anthony, and then I'll shut up. But
I'm just trying to help people understand more deeply and fully
The first is that I personally do not feel that the scriptures need to be taken literally. And I don't think the ELCA says that. Secondly, then, I don't understand why I would be called to take the creed literally. And I've heard people argue why the creed should be literal and why the creed even has predominance over the scriptures, which is not the way I see it.
Okay, I'd like to hear from some other people in the group that haven't spoken.
There is only one, of course.
Oh. I'm just going to ramble, I think. I really identify with a lot that Jim just said. And I know when I have felt oppressed by the people who know the rules and the stuff, the professors and the theologians, who, by the way, don't agree with each other. But boy, when they tell me, I just sort of sit up and listen because that's the way it was in class. And I get nervous about statements from the bishops. Although for me, baptizing in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit is not so much a problem because that's a statement of becoming a membership in the church, and that's what the church is saying. Why can't we be eclectic in the way that we are with music? That we have learned that music has a rich tradition that we bring, and it's in the LBW, and there's all kinds of stuff. But then we hear Mary and Tom, and they teach us all kinds of other stuff, and then we put all that together in the same worship service, and we have celebrated something in terms of unity and experience. And it didn't all have to be the same. It didn't have to be by the rules, whoever made the rules. And could we not also do, I mean, it seems to me, when Dan does his benediction, whichever one he chooses that day, at Vespers each night, they have such a wonderful difference to them. And some I like better than others, but they all have a way of drawing us all in. So I lean I also lean toward the inclusivity, but I don't feel that need to push away everything that comes out of the tradition. And I don't hear you saying that either. I just want to go back to one comment about children. I remember a little girl named Colleen. In our church, we had two pastors, both male, but it happened that two Sundays in a row, I was a lay professional, so I preached one Sunday, and then we had a guest preacher, a woman who was a pastor. And Colleen was doing her God bless us the next day at the foot of the bed that Sunday, and then she God blessed the different pastors. And then her mom said, you know, you could be a pastor someday. Oh no, she said, only boys are pastors. She was four. And her mother said, but you saw Betsy and you saw Judy. No, no, she said, only boys are pastors. And there was no persuading that little girl. And I can't help but think that language and who stood up in front over and over and over again had its impact on how she saw herself in relationship to the church. So I asked myself, how important is language? It's just real important.